You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. Each week, I break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news, and I interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter at nonzero.org. In this episode, AI tries to become a whistleblower and gets labeled a rat. The GOP pushes to get Chinese students out of American universities. And a leading economist explains how Trump's policy toward Venezuela drives immigration to the U.S. Welcome to Non-Zero World. I'm your host, Connor Eccles. President Trump, in a sudden about-face that reflects tensions within his administration, chose not to renew a license that allowed Chevron to export Venezuelan oil. According to the Washington Post, the decision, announced just a day after Trump envoy Richard Grenell promised to renew the license, came in response to pressure from Secretary of State Marco Rubio and several Republican lawmakers in Florida, who hoped to oust the Nicolas Maduro regime in Venezuela through a maximum pressure campaign. Grenell and Rubio have butted heads since the beginning of the current administration over Grenell's desire to seek détente with Maduro, according to the Washington Post. Secretary Rubio said the Trump administration will, quote, aggressively revoke visas for Chinese students, adding that this would particularly focus on those with connections to the Chinese Communist Party or who study in, quote unquote, critical fields. Rubio's short, vague statement on the topic will likely spread anxiety among America's 275,000 Chinese students, the New York Times reports. The move comes as Trump tries to ban Harvard from enrolling foreign students altogether, citing, among other things, its links to people and institutions that are in turn linked to China's defense industrial base. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman John Molinar has persuaded the University of Michigan to cut ties with a Chinese university and has accused colleges of helping create a, quote, Trojan horse for Beijing, end quote. President Trump signed an executive order that aims to quadruple U.S. nuclear power within 25 years, largely by streamlining regulation in a way that critics say could compromise safety. The move would transfer some authority from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to the Energy Department, a controversial expansion of executive power. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum said the U.S. needs the electricity to win an AI arms race with China, asserting that, quote, what we do in the next 5 years related to electricity is going to determine the next 50, end quote. Apparently, large language models would make for great whistleblowers. Anthropic safety testers told the company's LLM, Claude Opus 4, to, quote unquote, act boldly in the service of such values as integrity, transparency, and public welfare before giving it fake reports about an invented pharmaceutical company's drug trial. Acting boldly, the AI composed emails to federal regulators and media outlets in which it attempted to blow the whistle on what it deemed corporate misconduct, including the cover-up of patient deaths, according to the Nieman Lab. Anthropic said that Opus 4 is unlikely to repeat this sort of behavior outside of extreme testing conditions. Four Palestinians died in a chaotic rush on a food warehouse in Gaza after Israel partially lifted its months-long blockade on the territory. A day earlier, Israeli soldiers fired on crowds at another distribution site, killing one and injuring dozens more. Meanwhile, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert called Israel's war in Gaza, quote, indiscriminate, unrestrained, brutal, and criminal, adding, yes, Israel is committing war crimes. Robert Burke, a four-star admiral, was convicted of bribery and conspiracy for agreeing to steer funds toward a military contractor in exchange for a high-paying job. Burke has said the scheme, which would have helped a New York e-commerce company land a Pentagon contract for officer leadership training, was actually an attempt to reduce corruption in the Navy. Over 80% of former four-star officers that retired between 2018 and 2023 went on to work for military contractors, according to the Quincy Institute. Now let's go to my interview with Francisco Rodriguez, who is the former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly and is currently a professor at the University of Denver. You can follow Francisco on X at Fr Rodriguez C. I hope you'll stick around for what is a great conversation. Hey, Francisco, how you doing?
Hi, how are you, Connor?
Very good. Very good. Well, thank you for coming on the show. Why don't I go ahead and introduce you? I've actually already introduced you a little bit, but it's worth doing again because it's quite an impressive resume. You are the former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly. You're currently professor at the University of Denver. You've worked at the UN in the private sector, and your latest book, which will be relevant very much to our conversation today, is The Collapse of Venezuela from the University of Notre Dame Press. So is there anything I've missed? Have I been comprehensive?
I think you have, yes.
Okay, I covered it all. Well, I'm glad. That's good. So that gives the context on why you are the perfect person for the conversation that we're going to have today, which is sort of about the relationship between a pair of different policy priorities within the Trump administration. On the one side, you have a desire to drive down migration to the U.S., particularly illegal migration, but really migration in general. And on the other, you have at least some members of the administration who are very determined to oust Nicolas Maduro from power in Venezuela through the use of sanctions. Now, you've written that there is a significant amount of tension, obviously, between those two goals. But why don't we go ahead and start with a bit of a big picture question to kind of get us into the conversation, which is, what role have U.S. sanctions played in the collapse of Venezuela's economy over the past, let's say, 15 or 20 years?
Well, they played a very significant role. They are not the only factor. Venezuela's economic collapse is a complex phenomenon. It's been deeply influenced by the country's economic policies and by the country's institutions. However, I've done considerable work in trying to disentangle some of these effects, the effect of sanctions, the effects of policies, the effects of mismanagement, the effect of economic and political conflict. And what I've found is, first of all, just to give some dimension of the Venezuelan case, which is really important. Venezuelan per capita GDP declined between 2012 and 2020 by 71.5%. Wow. That's the equivalent of three consecutive Great Depressions. It is, in fact, the largest documented peacetime economic collapse in world economic history. There are some cases which have seen higher collapses, but those have been during war times when you have armies that are bombarding factories and economic centers. But in peacetime, it's relatively rare. And what I've found is that approximately half of that economic contraction can be attributed to sanctions, broadly understood, including the restrictions that the U.S. And primarily the U.S. government has put on trade and finance with Venezuela, as well as a number of other measures which sometimes are not called sanctions, but have similar effects, such as, for example, the fact that the U.S. and here also a number of other countries decided not to recognize the government of Venezuela, but to recognize the country's opposition and also to hand over to the opposition the control of the country's offshore international reserves or country's external assets. All of that have hampered the ability of the Venezuelan government to have access to resources, but it also hampered the ability of the Venezuelan economy to be able to generate the export revenue from the country's oil exports that has traditionally been the lifeblood of this economy. And therefore, it significantly contributed to the country's economic contraction. And it's very relevant to our conversation because Venezuela is also the largest documented mass exodus of persons in the Western Hemisphere. We're talking about 8 million Venezuelans who have left the country. That is approximately one quarter of the population. And we've seen Venezuelan immigrants settling over the region, in the United States, in Europe, in many other countries. So it's a very highly visible phenomenon that has had a deep impact on the societies to which these migrants have gone, and sanctions have played a significant role in generating this economic collapse.
Right. And what's the exact structure of these sanctions? Because I understand them to not necessarily be complete, right? Like in theory, one could do business with the Venezuelan government. Is that right? But it's mainly on the oil sector.
Well, actually, that's an interesting question. So the main sanctions that have economic impact are imposed by the U.S. And one would first ask, well, if it's only the U.S., can't Venezuela then do business with other countries? You know, why is the U.S. that important in that sense? Well, it's because the U.S. imposes also what are known as secondary sanctions, which is that the U.S. Will sanction companies in other countries that decide to do business with Venezuela. So legally, the U.S. has no direct jurisdictional power to be able to, say, bar a Spanish company from doing business with Venezuela. But what it can do is to tell the Spanish company, if you do business with Venezuela, I won't allow you to do business with the U.S. And that means I won't allow you to have access to the U.S. financial system. You won't be able to process a wire through a U.S. bank. And that is a significant penalty for any multinational company that has effectively deterred many of them from doing business with Venezuela. Now, the question of what type of business you can do with Venezuela, well, you do point to an important factor, which is that there is no general trade embargo with Venezuela. It's not like Cuba. You're not barred from buying Venezuelan goods. You're just barred from buying Venezuelan oil. But Venezuelan oil is 96% of the country's exports. So there is a sense in which this is, for all effects and purposes, an embargo. If you're a U.S. person, you are barred from doing any business with the Venezuelan government. So not just oil related. What you can do is non-oil business with the Venezuelan private sector. But you know, these differences are sometimes overplayed because the fact is that, and we see the same thing in many oil exporters. We saw it in Iraq in the 1990s. We saw it in Iran. We saw it in Libya. If you effectively impede the country from exporting oil and from generating revenue, then yes, you can say, all other transactions are permitted, and you can even claim. I mean, this gives the countries imposing sanctions sometimes this plausible deniability argument in which they can claim, oh, but, you know, they're not barred from doing business with the U.S. They're not barred from importing humanitarian goods. And that's like kind of like telling somebody who has just been fired and has just lost their job, hey, but you can go and buy anything. I mean, you've just lost your income, but, you know, you're not being barred from going to a store and buying whatever you want. Well, they are because they don't have the income to buy them. What's important to understand about these sanctions is that they target the income of the Venezuelan economy, and that is extremely destructive to any economy.
Right. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I mean, what does it look like for that to trickle down through the economy? Because we've seen these sanctions now we've seen them under Democratic and Republican administrations. They were in some ways strengthened by Trump in his first term, slightly lightened by Biden, I guess, and now being strengthened again, perhaps. But how kind of concretely have they led to more extreme conditions on the ground?
Yeah. Well, that's a very interesting question. So something you have to understand about the Venezuelan economy is that the Venezuelan economy, because of its high oil dependence, there's a way in which it functions, which is very different from, say, the way in which the U.S. economy or many other economies function. And when the country exports less oil, people feel that pretty much immediately because there are less dollars available for imports. And what will happen? It's really quite interesting because in Venezuela, everybody knows what the price of oil is. Like it's everybody knows that this is a key variable that is going to determine how the economy is doing and is going to determine even their own personal economic future. So when price of oil, historically, when the price of oil has gone up, then the country has gone through economic booms. When the price of oil has come down, then the country has gone through recessions. And one of the reasons that people know it and that it matters a lot is that when the oil revenues come down, The way in which it's translated to the economy is that the country's central bank, which is the one that receives all the foreign currency revenue, can sell less dollars. And therefore, what you know, the way that you see it immediately, is that the price of dollars goes up. But since this is an oil exporting economy, which imports a lot of what people need, including food and including inputs for the country's agricultural sector, then what you end up also seeing immediately when the price of the dollar goes up, when what we economists call the currency depreciating, you also end up seeing is that the price of just about everything that you can buy, say, in the country's supermarkets goes up. So there's a direct link, and this is why people know what the price of oil is, because they know that depending on changes in the price of oil, that's going to affect changes in the dollar, and that's going to affect how much they have to pay for groceries. So the main effect is that life becomes more expensive. When there are less dollars, life becomes more expensive in Venezuela, and people's wages are just not enough in order to be able to buy the basic things that they would have been able to buy when there were more oil revenues. And then there's a second order effect, which is that these oil revenues are also part of the income of the government. And as the government gets less revenue, the government has to cut back in spending. The government has to do, typically it reacts by doing two things. One of them can be cutting back on spending. Another one is just letting the deficit grow. But a higher deficit in a developing country like Venezuela, very different from the U.S. because the U.S. Can issue dollars. The Federal Reserve has a currency that has international standing. But with Venezuela, the Venezuelan currency, if you start printing money, then that immediately generates inflation. So there's another feedback effect, which is that it's not just that the price of the dollar is going up and imported, and the price of imported goods are going up. It's just that because of the higher deficit and because the government has begun to print money, then you see inflation skyrocketing. And in fact, if you look at many of the recent episodes of hyperinflations, for example, seeing hyperinflations in Zimbabwe, in Venezuela, earlier, like towards the end of the last century, you saw also an episode of hyperinflation. I mean, hyperinflations are relatively rare events. We're talking about annual inflation of higher than 12,000%. You saw this in Yugoslavia. A classic example is Germany after World War I with the Weimar Republic. And in all of those, you're talking about sanctioned economies. I mean, in the case of Germany, they didn't call it sanctions at the time. They called it reparations, but it was basically the same. So when these governments are under deep stress, they resort to printing money that accelerates inflation. They also resort to cutting spending. And sometimes they cut spending intentionally. Sometimes just that spending is eroded by inflation. As inflation starts accelerating and the government budget can't keep up, and what you have is wages in the government sector going down, but also investment spending in building schools and buying inputs for hospitals. So the public health system starts to deteriorate. Social assistance also begins to deteriorate. So the value, the real value of pensions, for example, of old age pensions, starts going down. And that means that it's not only that those who work and earn a living see that their wages are not enough to buy groceries. It's that pensioners feel the double effect. Everything is getting more expensive, and also the value of their pensions is going down. So those are the different ways in which the effect of sanctions trickles to ordinary people.
Right. No, that's very helpful, because I think that we often talk about this in very broad ways, but I think that really put a lot of meat on that. I'm curious, I guess. So we should get to the exact sort of different ways in which the Trump administration is balancing between these things. But what is the exact, about how many of the migrants that are coming to the U.S. These days are coming from Venezuela, or in recent years? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, yes, it's been, so as I said, there were 8 million Venezuelan migrants that have left the country over the course of the past decade, a bit more than a decade. Of those, around 900,000 have come into the U.S. It is the fastest growing. It has been, at least up until 2024, it had been the fastest growing foreign-born population in the U.S. And there were periods in which it was the single largest contributor to U.S. immigration, despite the fact that there are countries that, in terms of absolute size and also of proximity, like Mexico itself, are much larger. So those are the ones that traditionally tend to dominate migration flows. But yes, and we've also seen it in the salience and the political relevance of discussions around Venezuelan immigration. In fact, as we saw, the Trump administration recently invoked the Alien Enemies Act to deport Venezuelans whom it claims are linked to a criminal gang called the Tren de Aragua, despite the fact that there is very little evidence that is the case. It's definitely been an immigration that has captured public attention and been at the center of political debate in the U.S.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, why don't we go ahead and talk about what the Trump administration has or hasn't done, and a little bit about sort of the disagreements, seemingly internally, over how to approach this problem, because they seem to be aware of this tension, I guess. But recently, you know, I mentioned this before you came on the show on an earlier segment, where the Venezuelan, there's a license that the U.S. has issued in previous times for Chevron to work with the Venezuelan National Oil Company to import oil to the United States. The Trump administration seemed like it was going to approve that license, extend that license rather, and then suddenly revoked it and offered a much narrower one in its place that is more similar to ones that had been there in the past. Can you talk about the sort of back and forth there and the effect of that move?
Yeah, sure. As you described, there's been quite a lot of tensions within the Trump administration, both at the level of the contradiction between migration policy and the goal of lowering irregular migration in the U.S. and even the direct objective of deporting irregular migrants back to their home countries. And then on the other hand, you have this neoconservative faction that really takes Venezuela almost as a point of honor. And that's mostly represented by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, that really wants to go back to the idea of imposing what they call maximum pressure on Venezuela. They believe or claim to believe that if you put enough pressure on the Venezuelan economy, then that's going to lead to a change of government. That's going to lead to the overthrow of Nicolas Maduro. The way that this has expressed itself most directly is in the conflict between Rubio and the special envoy for special situations of President Trump, Richard Grenell. So Grenell has been tasked with helping negotiate a number of internationally sensitive issues, and he's particularly been focused from day one on Venezuela. And in fact, one of the first actions that were taken in foreign policy of the administration was Richard Grenell's trip to Venezuela, where he met with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, and he achieved the release of five Americans that had been detained in Venezuela and had been charged with various crimes. He was able to come back with them to the U.S. and reach an agreement on deportation flights so that Venezuela would start accepting flights of deported Venezuelan migrants. So you've had this crack of negotiations with Venezuelan government going on. And then at the same time, you've had Marco Rubio from the Department of State trying to impose and advocate for different measures that will increase the pressure on Venezuela. And there's also another dynamics that has played out, which is that Marco Rubio has also been looking for alternatives to deportation flights to Venezuela. And he was instrumental in reaching the agreement with the president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, in which El Salvador has decided to accept deported Venezuelan migrants, which are housed, in fact, in a security facility in El Salvador under very questionable conditions, because there's really been essentially no due process associated. These are Venezuelans who are not only is there no due process in terms of their being deported from the U.S., also they're being deported to a prison. I mean, if you're deported from a country, you're deported to your home country. Right. You're not being charged with anything. You know, you can go back to your home country and continue to live your life. In this case, they've actually fallen into this limbo, which was actually very similar to what happened in Guantanamo, which is that they're deported. They're not charged, but they're deported. And then they're also housed in a facility in which they are treated as convicts. I mean, they are in prison. So Rubio was instrumental in getting this deal done. And part of what I think has happened in the Trump administration is that because of the deportations and because of the just this very aggressive public discourse against immigrants, the ICE raids that are very prominent, in which immigrants are being detained under many conditions, the initiative to revoke visas, for example, under also very broad conditions, including if your social media accounts have been critical of the U.S. For foreign students. All of that appears to have led to just a decline in the willingness of people to try to come to the U.S., both legally and illegally. So there is a sense in which, at least for the time being, the administration, the Trump administration, believes that the problem of new irregular migration has been solved because the number of apprehensions at the border have declined. So that has also, you know, decreased the urgency of saying, well, let's do something that will allow the Venezuelan economy to recover. Because then in the end, from the standpoint of the Trump administration, of the America First philosophy, it doesn't really matter if the Venezuelan exodus continues, as long as they're going to other countries and they're not coming to the U.S. So this has partly been the split. And you know, it's still ongoing. So you were talking about the Chevron license. Yes, in effect, in May 27, just 3 days ago, the license that the Biden administration had granted to Chevron to be able to export Venezuelan oil to the U.S. Was left to expire. It had actually been renewed as a wind down license by the Trump administration, but the final extension was left to expire. Chevron does appear to have an authorization to continue to work in Venezuela. I say appear to because it's also a very interesting move. The Trump administration has decided that they're not going to make this authorization public. Previously, all, or at least the most relevant licenses, like the Chevron license, were published on OFAC's website. Now they're not. So we don't know under what conditions they've been authorized to remain, but we do know that they're there. We do know that their old license had expired and they're still operating in Venezuela. So effectively, they must count with some type of authorization, mm-hmm. given the fact that they're an American company. And there's also a sense in which internal political dynamics also play a very important role here, because what appears to have happened, according to investigating political reporting in this area, has been that a group of Florida legislators, Republican Florida legislators, who are of Cuban origin or heritage, have effectively pressured the Trump administration to revoke the Chevron license as a condition for obtaining their support to vote for President Trump's budget bill. And remember, this so-called One Big Beautiful Bill passed the House just by one vote. So these three legislators effectively were pivotal in gaining enough support for the bill. And it's been reported in several media that they actually made it a condition of their support that the license on Chevron were revoked. Because anything that seems as being tough on Venezuela, as being tough on Maduro, appears to play very well among a certain diaspora That's very important politically in Florida, not just of Venezuelan immigrants, but also of Cuban immigrants and in general, of Latin American immigrants that and particularly those who are close to the Republican Party, those who are Republican voters, do have a very hardline view of what policy should be with regards to governments like the Venezuelan one.
Right. And one thing I was curious if you could clarify a little. So we've got, you said that the Trump administration feels as if it's successfully sort of deterred people from coming to the U.S. in the first place. So they're thinking maybe we've balanced it out well. You mentioned specifically that border apprehensions are down. Was that the main path through which people were coming to the United States from Venezuela? Did it tend to be through the border as far as we know, or had it been more people like overstaying visas or making asylum claims at airports? Could you speak to that at all?
Yeah, I mean, asylum claims at airports are relatively small. The data on visa overstays is not that transparent or easy to analyze. So we don't have a good, clear picture of what the relative contribution is. But what we do know is that the Trump administration has clamped down on both. They're definitely doing everything, not just to increase border enforcement and patrolling. I think that that's been probably the least important element, but just to intimidate migrants, and particularly those who are planning on coming through irregular means, and to convince them that life in the U.S. is going to be very difficult for them. So that appears to have dissuaded the irregular migrants. And in terms of visa overstays, the U.S. just not issuing many visas now, particularly for countries from Venezuela. So the visa overstay problem that you had was important more at the beginning. At the beginning of the country's migration crisis and up until COVID, where the majority of Venezuelans who had entered on visas, and there you did have an issue of visa overstay. But in terms of new visas, I mean, remember, the U.S. does not have relations with Venezuela. The U.S. does not recognize the Maduro government. Therefore, the U.S. does not have an embassy in Venezuela. The U.S. embassy for Venezuela physically operates out of Colombia. So if you're a Venezuelan who wants to get a visa to travel to the U.S., you actually have to go to Colombia to try to get it there. And these applications have been now for some time effectively completely suspended. You can't overstay a visa because you can't get a visa to come to the U.S.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. In any case, I mean, it seems clear to me that the sanctions will at least increase, I guess, the number of people who will attempt to come to the United States, as we've been discussing. It is interesting to see the interplay between these. I wanted to get, you know, you're someone who has long obviously wanted a return to democracy in Venezuela. You care a great deal about democracy there. You've advised presidential candidates who have run against Maduro, for example. And what we've seen over the past 15 years has been that nothing seems to work, right? That there was a little bit of a period in which, and this is kind of me playing out and thinking about this maximum pressure argument versus the Rick Grenell approach that you had mentioned. But, you know, when the Biden administration, for example, issued that Chevron license, the hope was that it might lead to a more free and fair election in 2023. Of course, Maduro went on to steal that election. And we think that there's pretty strong evidence that he did falsify like the actual vote tallies. He's continued his sort of efforts to take a region away from neighboring Guyana. So like, what does it look like to actually have a policy that might be more successful in enticing the Maduro regime to give up power in the short or long term?
I mean, as a Venezuelan, I would like nothing more than for my country to be able to elect its president, to decide who its president is. And as you said, there is, I mean, in my view, the evidence is overwhelming that Maduro stole the election. And in fact, this was one of the most blatant and brazen electoral frauds that I have ever seen. And the opposition was able to document it very well, because the opposition was able to preserve copies of the official voting tallies by voting center, and to store and be able to present to the international community more than almost nearly 80% of voting tallies that clearly show that the opposition candidate Edmundo González won the presidential election. So yes, I mean it's a terrible situation, and you have atrocious human rights violations going on in Venezuela, perpetrated by the Maduro regime. I would like nothing more than to find a way in which the country can return to democracy. But I also think that when you are talking about what role a country like the U.S. can play in influencing the direction of other countries in terms of their institutions, in terms of their democracy, we have to be very cautious and very realistic. The U.S. attempts at creating democracy, at changing political regimes in the rest of the world, I think that to say that they've been unsuccessful is a bit of an understatement.
To say the least. Yeah.
So they've really been disastrous, and a lot of times they've made things worse. And also, there's like a deeper problem, which is that more than 80 countries in the world are classified according to the VDEM database, which is one of the which is I think right now the best attempt to measure political institutions are autocratic. So and more than 70% of the world's population lives in these countries. So how exactly is the U.S. or anybody going to go about like changing the political regimes that most of the world lives in? And what would that look like? And how much sense would that make? And because it doesn't make sense, then you end up in this situation in which somehow the U.S. like zeroes in some autocratic governments, and it really treats them hostilely. On the other hand, I mean, we see U.S. presidents, both Biden and Trump, say traveling to places like Saudi Arabia and taking photos with the leaders of these countries. I mean, including one, and I cite that particular case because it's somebody who effectively is perceived, I think, known to have ordered the killing and dismemberment of a journalist at a Saudi embassy. And this is the type of persons that U.S. presidents, Democrats and Republicans, are aiming for to get photo ops with them. So China's a one-party state. China is a dictatorship. Does that mean that we're not going to have relations with China? Does that mean that we're going to completely cut off trade with China, going to try to isolate it? What exactly would a world economy in which the U.S. tries to isolate all authoritarian governments be? Right now, most political scientists do not label the U.S. a full democracy. They label it as an intermediate regime, as a weak democracy with some elements of autocracy, including unclear separation of powers, including a tendency of the executive branch to overstep its authority, including head of the executive not recognizing the results of elections. So, which are the types of things that happen in regimes that are undergoing the process that's known as democratic backsliding. We also have this gaping contradiction, which is that Cuba and Venezuela are treated as dictatorships, but on the other hand, where are Venezuelan migrants being deported to El Salvador, which is also an authoritarian government, and the Salvadoran president has given a red carpet to come into the U.S. So in the end, what happens is that The U.S., you know, viewed from the international stage, actually starts looking like really just the U.S. foreign policy starts looking like an exercise in hypocrisy of picking and choosing some dictatorships to be, you know, our friends and other dictatorships to be our enemies, with no very clear criteria, or with a criteria that when it becomes clear, it looks like really distorted, such as, for example, catering to these diasporas. In fact, there's this amazing research that has actually shown that a country is much more likely to be sanctioned by the U.S. If there is a larger share of diaspora voters from that country in U.S. swing states.
That's very interesting.
It is fascinating. So what do you do in the case of if you want to do something to try to bring Venezuela closer to democracy? And something that I do think that we have to understand is that the Venezuelan political conflict is not new. It's not recent. It's something that's lasted more than a quarter century. And yes, the government is unpopular, and the government has stolen an election, and it's completely destroyed Venezuelan political and democratic institutions. Now, at the same time, the country's opposition has not always behaved democratically. It also, in 2002, tried to overthrow a democratically elected president, Hugo Chavez. It paralyzed the country's oil industry. I mean, we're talking about the destructive effect of sanctions when they're imposed by another country. Imagine when you have a political party or a political movement trying to do that internally, trying to destroy the country's oil industry. Well, that happened in Venezuela. I mean, it happened twice, actually. It happened in 2003 when the opposition called an oil strike, and it happened more recently because the opposition, in contrast to opposition movements in many countries, has actually called for and advocated for tighter U.S. sanctions, which, as we've discussed, do severe harm to the economy. And I think even more problematic is the fact that the Venezuelan political conflict is essentially a conflict that plays out as a winner-take-all conflict in which the groups that are in control of the opposition right now are the groups that have the more hardline vision. And that hardline vision essentially is the slogan of the Venezuelan opposition candidate, not Edmundo González, who won the election, but of María Corina Machado, who is the opposition leader, who was not allowed to run and therefore lent her support to Edmundo González, is hasta el final, to the end. And the way in which it's understood, the way in which she presents it, is as this is a final battle. This is the final battle between good and evil. We're the good, Chavismo is the evil. What that tells you is that there's a level of political conflict in Venezuela which goes beyond what can be resolved merely by an election. Or in other words, elections work when you already have a basic implicit understanding that coexistence between the political parts is possible, and that we're going to use some set of rules to try to resolve the difference between those. Venezuela is more in a civil war territory, actually, where both groups want to obliterate each other. And of course, elections are one way in which they do it, and the exercise of political violence is another way in which they do it. So I think that the Venezuelan conflict has to be viewed much more through the prism of conflict resolution. How do we get an agreement between these parts so they can resolve their differences peacefully? I mean, if you look at the way in which, you know, other conflicts like these have been addressed, I mean, think about, for example, apartheid era South Africa, and I think it's an appropriate example because apartheid was an abhorrent regime, And it's very good that it came to an end, but it came to an end through negotiation. It came to an end through an understanding between the country's different racial groups that they could forge a project of a society in which they could coexist. And if you actually look at the contrast between two countries in Africa that address these problems in different ways, you have South Africa, where you had a negotiated solution. You have Zimbabwe, where you didn't. And Zimbabwe is in much, much worse shape, not only economically, where Zimbabwe is also a case of an economic collapse, but also just in terms of the basic viability of its society. I mean, regrettably, we are seeing some of these elements come back now in South Africa, which tells you that, you know, these conflicts don't go away easily. But the way in which you can get out of them, or the way in which you can forge a way ahead that is peaceful, has to be through negotiation. That negotiation can't just be about, oh, let's hold an election to see who will hold power. Because if whoever holds power is going to try to obliterate their opponent, that's not going to solve the conflict. The negotiation has to be about how do we find a way in which both sides can agree to coexist, so that whoever loses the election will say, okay, I can give up power. I can be an opposition political party. I can participate in this country's political life. Losing the election doesn't mean that my opponents are just going to, you know, throw me in jail or put me on a plane and send me to a jail in El Salvador.
Right. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the South Africa example, because that is one where, you know, because I agree generally with your point of view that essentially, like, letting Venezuela figure it out, offering diplomatic resources to help perhaps do negotiations between the groups might be the ideal way that outside groups could get involved, but not more probably, right? But in the South African case, you actually did have sort of international isolation and economic sanctions, or at least boycotts that you saw. So do you see these things necessarily as mutually exclusive?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's quite important. Now, let me say something about the role of the U.S. in Venezuela just for a moment.
This was a free preview of Non-Zero World. To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at nonzero.org.